And in particular, what we know about early intervention is that it often has the largest benefits or most impact on children from vulnerable backgrounds. That's where we actually see the largest gains and differences.
The human brain is the most complex structure in the known universe, and we are in the middle of a scientific revolution to understand its inner workings. Join us for a conversation with world-renowned neuroscientists as they visit Rochester. I am Dr. John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester, and you are listening to Neuroscience Perspectives. I have a fantastic guest here today, Professor Brian Boyd from the University of North Carolina. And Brian is a researcher in the domain of developmental disabilities, very specifically focused on autism with a background in special education. We're going to dive into that with Brian momentarily. He's been dedicated to bringing solutions to the classroom and early intervention in autism, and in recent times has very specifically turned to dealing with this in underrepresented and marginalized communities in the Black community. Brian is, and he has a long title, he is the William C. Friday Distinguished Professor of Education, and he's the Interim Director of the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina. Brian, it's really fantastic to have you here in Rochester. We want to dive in, get to know you a little bit. Actually, before we get into the science and we get into developmental disabilities, tell us a little bit about, you know, growing up. How did you end up? Where did you go to school and all the rest of it? What were the motivations in life?
Sure, thank you. Well, first of all, John, it's wonderful to be here. So thank you for having me. So I grew up in a very small town in Virginia, population of less than 1,000. So it's rural Virginia. For those who know Virginia, it's really split between Southern Virginia and Northern Virginia. And the Northerners don't really claim the state the same way because they consider themselves sort of part of Maryland, right, and DC in that sort of area. But I grew up, my grandparents had operated a farm, really. So I grew up in a small farm town, really. You know, in that small town, you know, it was real sense of community. And that sense of community really sort of inspired me to think about sort of my own education and the opportunities that I wanted to avail myself of. It was a very supportive community in many ways because it was such a small town, all of us knew each other. I was a first generation college student. When I went off to college, I went to did my undergraduate at the College of William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia.
Jefferson's University?
Yes, yeah. Yes it is, Jefferson's University. Second oldest university,
right.
We like to say, in the US. And there I sort of started down this pathway of autism at the College of William & Mary. From there, after I graduated, I worked for a little bit at the Teach Autism program in the state of North Carolina. So that gave me certainly much more of an introduction to autism and autism research. And then sort of because of some people I met there, I was inspired to continue my studies and go on to graduate school, and then did a master's of education at the University of Virginia, and ultimately my PhD in special education at the University of Florida. So that's sort of my pathway, if you will. And then I ended up back in Chapel Hill for a postdoc at UNC Chapel Hill.
Right. And, you know, I mean, just you came from a farming community, mm-hmm. a small town,
yeah.
Not an academic background, is
that's
that
right.
true to say? And, I mean, when you were making this jump to really the highest levels of education, was that new for your family and your community? Was that a thing for you?
It was certainly new for my family. Yes, like I said, neither of my parents went to college. So I was a first-generation college student. So that experience was new for my immediate family. Certainly I had extended family members who had gone to university and gone to college, but not in my immediate family. So navigating that was a journey. But I think part of what I really had were just two supportive parents who were there and willing to help me navigate this sort of novel situation that they had no experience with, but they were there to listen. And when issues or problems arise. So I think just knowing that they were supportive of what I was trying to do really meant a lot and sort of inspired me to continue.
Right. And then how early would you have had this sort of thought, I want to be in education, and specifically, you know, in kids, you know, who are not neurotypical, who are struggling?
Yeah. I'm not sure when I was in high school, again, this was a very small town, that I interacted with a lot of students with disabilities. At the time I was in school, school was pretty segregated. You know, the students with disabilities that did exist existed in totally separate classrooms. I don't remember any students being included.
Mainstreaming.
At least in my school. Again, this was a small school with not a ton of students. And almost all of them, I do believe, rode sort of separate buses. So there was almost separation between us who were neurotypical and students with disabilities. So it really wasn't until I got to college, and I was actually doing some undergraduate research with a social psychology professor, but this was in the days before computers were plentiful, and we used to print out data and check things line by line. I was like, oh my gosh, this is the most tedious job ever. I don't want to spend my entire summer doing this. And I had taken what was then called abnormal psychology in a normal psychology course. And in the textbook, there was really literally no more than a paragraph about autism. And this was the late 90s. But something about that paragraph sort of stuck out to me. And I really can't explain what it was. But I ended up searching online, however we search before Google. And what popped up, likely because of proximity of the state of North Carolina to the state of Virginia, was a camp called Camp Royal that's located in Pittsboro, North Carolina.
Right.
And I decided to apply there to become a camp counselor. And, you know, most of us who were camp counselors were undergraduate college students. For many of us, it was our first exposure that we knew of to autism. But it was 10 weeks of working with autistic individuals of varying ages, varying support needs, varying ability levels. And it was that experience that really led me to continue in the field.
Right. And was there something specific about interacting with kids with autism? Talk to me about that, you know, that human-to-human interaction. Is there something there that really just gets you going? Is that the thing?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, there really is. What led me into special education specifically was after I finished up at the camp, at Camp Royal, what used to happen was almost on a weekly basis, clinical psychology interns who worked at the TEACH program would come out and support us sort of novice camp counselors. And I was talking to one of them and said, I think I want to continue in autism. I'll be graduating soon. You know, do you have any recommendations? And the person said, I suggest you contact Gary Mezebov, who at the time was the director of the TEACH autism program. I had no idea who Gary Mezebov was. But I cold called him, and for some reason, Gary Mezebov called me back. And, you know, to make it a shorter story, he offered me a job at the TEACH Autism program. But one of the things I got to do was work in a classroom for preschool age children. And at the time, we also started a program for newly diagnosed 2-year-olds. And again, this is the late 90s when we weren't diagnosing as many 2-year-olds with autism. And in that program, you know, I had this wonderful experiences, interactions with young children and their parents and hearing their stories, right? And just seeing the growth, like what transpired in such a short amount of time, the transformations I saw in those kids just by, you know, this was really 3 or 4 hours of exposure to a classroom a day.
Yeah.
But it was really wonderful experiences. And actually, one of the kids who was in that 2-year-old program, I recently had some contact with his dad, and he's now a college student, and he's majoring in jazz. He's becoming a jazz musician. So just those kinds of stories and interactions are just sort of really sustain you in many ways.
Yeah. You know? I do think, you know, you see parents interacting with kids. Parents love their kids. Mm. But neurotypical folks, you know, they're going about their day. But when you see parents interacting with a child with a developmental disability, you see love in the moment right there. There's something very inspiring about that, I think, for people who work in our field.
Absolutely.
I'm sort of constantly reminding you why you're here. Now that brings me to something, you know, you've chosen really to be at the intervention, the pointy end of the system, mm-hmm. right? I need to deliver solutions for people. Tell us about that and what's effective? Where do you see the grist in the mill here?
Yeah. And actually that to some degree started, that inspiration also started during that time in the Teach Autism program because we were in the classroom. And there was a period of time where we didn't have a full-time teacher. And at that time, I did not have a teaching license. I hadn't gone to, I hadn't received my master's of education yet. So they brought in someone who was a former teacher, but currently completing her doctoral studies in special education at UNC Chapel Hill. And this person worked in the classroom. And part of what I saw her do with kids and how she applied what she was learning within her PhD program to the work she was doing with children sort of inspired me to continue and to move into the education realm. You know, and so really that intervention research, you know, I just had so many questions as a result of that experience. Why did some kids improve so much? You know, how do we help, you know, most kids gain the maximal benefit? And I was exposed to different intervention programs. I did teach for a while. I did applied behavior analysis. I got exposed to floor time. You know, a number of us in the field know there was a recent paper by Amy Weatherby and others showing that, you know, early intervention does have a difference. There is something related to timing of exposure to intervention then that can make a difference for outcomes. But I think we know that more broadly to some degree in the field that early intervention matters. You know, as you, when you introduced me, you talked about that I'm interim director at the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute. And that institute is really famous for a landmark study that was done in the US called the Apsiderian study. And that study was started in the 1970s where it was a randomized controlled trial where children living in poverty were randomized to receive high quality classroom-based intervention or usual services.
Right.
Those folks have been followed now into adulthood, and they continue to have better outcomes, health outcomes, employment outcomes, less contact with the criminal justice system, all because, it seems, of exposure to high quality early intervention and early development. So we know that early intervention can have long-term positive outcomes.
Profound
positive outcomes. And in particular, what we know about early intervention is that it often has the largest benefits or most impact on children from vulnerable backgrounds. That's where we actually see the largest gains and differences. So, you know, obviously students with disabilities, autistic students are a vulnerable group. And we can think about them in that space of how we sort of maximize their development early in life to achieve the best gains later in life. But the second part of your question, right, is, you know, I think we're still unpacking autism. It is heterogeneous, and we certainly deal with that on the intervention side of things as well. How do we think about sort of what baseline characteristics of children sort of moderate intervention, their response to intervention? And I think we're still sorting that out to some degree. I think we certainly know that children who have co-occurring intellectual disability often have a different response than students who don't have a co-occurring intellectual disability. And where I've been going in my research is then, you know, what does it mean for students who are from racially minoritized backgrounds? And, you know, what is their intervention response? And should we be thinking more about culturally tailoring of our interventions as a result? And so I do think we're trying to move to this place of how do we best stratify. And maybe, you know, we need a combination of not just behavioral factors, but biological factors, right, that may better help us figure out who will respond to which intervention. I think we're still moving in that direction to some degree.
We're in a strange time, right, in American political history. We're in a time where there's a movement to say we shouldn't be classifying anybody according to race. Those days are over. Does this worry you? I mean, obviously, you know, from a science perspective, you can add high vulnerability to racially marginalized, underrepresented groups and that. Are you worried about this? I don't want to get you deep into the politics. I know you're a scientist, but no. I mean, how does that play into your thinking these days?
Yeah, I mean, Yes, it's worrisome to some degree. I mean, as we all know, race is a social construct, right? There's really no biological basis for race itself. But I wish that we were all starting at a place of equality, that all racial groups were treated the same. We know that is not the case. But we also know that the driver of disparity is not race, but underlying racism, and that how racial groups are treated differently as a result of sort of physical characteristics, in this case, the color of their skin. So if we can get to a place of equality in this country, then I think we can have some different discussions about race. But until we solve the underlying issues of racism that are driving the disparities we're seeing in various communities across various outcomes, then I think we still have some work to do. And as we all know, that this issue of equity that people are talking about, while it may seem like a scary word or buzzword, as we ultimately know, it's really just a concept of fairness, of providing people what they need, of really tailoring things to people, right? Because not everyone needs the same,
notion,
right?
Yeah.
It shouldn't be controversial because we know that not everyone needs the same thing, right? Yeah. And so now we're just talking about that within the context of really social classes and societal hierarchies, right? That some groups are treated differently because of different reasons. And so how do we provide those groups what they need? So I hope we can have some more balanced conversations, because I think these conversations benefit all children and all of us as society if we can think about issues of fairness.
Sorry to drag you into political space, but I really appreciate your answer there. And I appreciate the work that you're doing with youngsters. You're really in the trenches. You're up to your elbows in trying to bring solutions, bring a better life, allow kids to live the best possible life. And I just think, you know, what could be better than that? I think all of us in the neurosciences are proud of you and proud of what you do. Let me ask you one last question. I always ask this question. You know, you've had an amazing life, really. You know, you've reached the absolute pinnacle of the academy from a small town in Virginia. When you talk to your graduate students or youngsters in the schools, and if they say, like, you know, how do I do what Brian Boyd did? Do you have some pearls of wisdom for them? Advice for them?
Yeah, I guess two pieces of advice for me, and I think for other people in the field that I've interacted with as well. You know, mentors are really important. You know, find your supportive mentoring network. And sometimes you need mentors for different reasons. Sometimes it's not just about the science. Sometimes it's just about navigating academia. When I was in my doctoral program, one of my mentors was a Latina woman. And I talked to her about what it's like being a minority in the academy. And those were the conversations we had. But they were really important for my career. So find your mentoring network, that support. The other I would say to people, and I often hear this from students who are from marginalized backgrounds, this whole concept of imposter syndrome, and I feel like an imposter. And I would say that, again, most people I've talked to in the academy, at some point in their career, felt like an imposter. So know that you've been invited into that room for a reason. So just show up and be your authentic self. So those are my two pieces of advice.
Brian, such a pleasure to have you here. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, John.
For taking some time out.
Yeah.